Moncrief on News Talk.
As you know, people nowadays can get very het up about issues to do with gender and sexuality. So in that regard, can we learn anything from animals? Are things more straightforward for them? Nathan Lentz is the author of The Sexual Evolution. Afternoon, Nathan.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
I was surprised to read in your book because I was always under the impression that swans mate for life, but that's not necessarily true.
Well, they might mate for life, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're sexually exclusive. I think humans tend to pair those two concepts up, like the pairing up, the bonding and the sexual exclusivity. But most animals don't do that. So they form a partnership with, two or even sometimes more, but they'll still have sexual activity outside of that partnership.
Okay, so it's like it's more like the equivalent of an open relationship they have.
That's right. And what's interesting about it is that it takes a different shape in all different species. So, what really makes sense for them? And there's really good reasons why they may or may not engage in these sort of extramarital sexual activity. And sometimes they try to prevent each other and sometimes they don't. Really interesting behaviors have been found and discovered once we kind of opened our eyes and looked beyond just comparing them to our relationships.
Okay. And so what would be the reasons for them doing that? To try and in some instances try to enforce exclusivity and others not?
Well, if you think about it, the best strategy long-term for a species or for an individual even is diversity. You want to have a diversity of offspring because you got to remember, no matter how well adapted you are right now, the environment is always changing. There's no way to predict what the best features will be in the future. And so what a lot of animals do is pursue a variety of mates so that they're mixing their genes up with a variety of other genes. They're not just throwing in their investment with just one animal, because even if that's the best one they can find, it's not a variety. The variety is still better than whatever the best means at that particular moment. And so both of them pursue genetic diversity, for different reasons. Now, because in some species, the way that reproduction bears on males and females is different. In some species, it's not that different, but in some species it is. Then the way that they'll approach that diversity is different. And that's when it gets really interesting to look at how the males, females, and other kinds of animals really pursue their own interests.
Yeah. Now, given all that, why do animals, is it some animals, most animals, a significant proportion of animals, engage in same-sex sexual activity?
Well, so there are a variety of reasons that animals have sex. So we think of sex in animals anyway as only for procreation. But just like for us, animals have sex for a whole variety of reasons. Only rarely or only occasionally is it meant to actually conceive. I mean, think about how many times you have sex. What percentage of those had anything to do with procreation? And the thing is, it's the same thing with animals. So sometimes they use sex to climb the social ladder, to build alliances, to get a higher station. Sometimes they use it for dominance and try to make someone submissive. Sometimes they do it to strengthen the pair bond. Sometimes they do it just for fun. There's a whole variety of reasons why animals have sex with each other. So if you think about that, then actually same-sex sexual activity would be expected, because then you would be missing out on the chance to pursue all of those interests with like half of the population. If you're only attracted to half, well, then you're missing opportunities with the other half. And so most animals are kind of in this bisexual or pansexual middle where they might have proclivities one way or the other, but they'll have sex whenever it makes sense for them, whenever they see an opportunity to advance their own position. So for example, a lot of mammals actually exist in these sex segregated groupings where the males hang out together and the females hang out together, and they only really come together for procreation. But in their sex segregated groups, a lot of times there's a lot of jockeying for power and position, and there's building alliances and there's fighting. There's all kinds of interesting behaviors, and sex is one of those that plays a role in their social life.
Okay, yeah. But I assume then in a certain amount of instances, people are just having sex. The reason most of us do is just having sex for fun.
That's right. And animals do that too. Why wouldn't they? You got to remember that sex is linked up to the reward center in our brain. You get the immediate release of dopamine. And if you do it in the context of a relationship, you get that serotonin. There's a lot of feel-good neurochemistry. And remember, We know this in humans, but we know more about it in animals because the experimentation that led to these discoveries was actually done in animals. So we know that sex fires the reward and the pleasure center in the brain. So it would be actually weird if animals didn't do it just for fun. I mean, you might have a dog or cat or other animal, you'll see that it will hump basically anything it can. And sometimes that they do it for no other reason than it feels good.
Yeah. And what's interesting about a lot of this is the way it's been reported on, or, you know, when it was first observed by scientists, that they might have kind of nudged the truth a little bit, for instance. And to this day, it kind of people might have this conception that young lions, male lions, are wrestling, but they're actually doing more than wrestling.
Yeah, they are. A lot of male lions will have sex with each other. And what's interesting is that the reasons why. So sometimes they do it for social cohesion. Sometimes they do it for bonding. But as you said, a lot of times it's wrestling. And what that means is it's a dominant struggle. And so it is one of the ways that they work out rank. Because in a lion pride, rank is everything. Rank comes with feeding privileges, sexual privileges, other kinds of privileges. And so by having sex in this kind of Greco-Roman wrestling style, it's a alternative to fighting. Because when you fight, there are injuries. You know, even if you win in a fight, you could still, you know, suffer injuries. So sex is sort of a more safe way to establish rank. And, you know, and some people would say that, oh, well, then that's not really sex. Well, here's the thing. It's penetration, there's orgasm, it's sex in every, it meets the definition of sex in every way. It's just a different use of sex. And once you expand your mind and realize that there's different uses of sex, different contexts, then you realize, wow, they're having sex for a whole variety of reasons. And those reasons are interesting, and we've been ignoring them for far too long. It's time to take sexual social behaviors in animals much more seriously, because you learn interesting things. And sometimes there's parallels to us and sometimes not. But either way, you know, we can really appreciate the richness of their social lives.
And one of the reasons, one of the more kind of odd ones to me, is that a penguin will have sex with someone if you give them a stone.
Yeah, so lots of species will actually trade sexual access for resources. So you can kind of purchase your way into bed with some animals. And the reason they do this, again, is if you can think about, you know, granting sexual access is a commodity. It's something that an animal has that it can offer something else, and it can jockey for position. They can improve their own position. And so penguins, because these stones are the only thing they have to really build nests with. They don't have, you know, branches and twigs and things. So they only have these stones, and not all stones are equal. Some are much better at stacking and making a nest. So some females will actually grant sexual access to a male in exchange for one of these prized stones. So one the way I put it in the book is, well, the oldest profession indeed. The animals have long figured out that they can trade sexual access for, you know, commodities.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to gender, now, of course, you can't ask an animal, what gender do you identify as? So it's really based on kind of our inference to a certain extent. But it was interesting to see, I don't want to destroy Finding Nemo for people, but that wasn't really quite accurate as to what might have happened.
That's right. So in a clownfish family, they'll have only one female. And when the female is lost, as what happened in the beginning of the movie, the next largest fish will always be a male. That male will switch sex and become a female so that the group always has one female, and that female is always the largest and oldest member of the group. And then the next oldest one will be the breeding male, and so on. So if the picture had been accurate, what really would happen is by the time that Marlin, his father, had found Nemo, he would have been Marlena. He would have been his mother by that point. And of course, the other weird thing is that then he would have started breeding with Nemo, and probably that's not a, you know, good children's movie to tell. But again, the story is much more interesting when we look and we take their sex and gendered behaviors more interesting. But you mentioned that we can't ask an animal about its gender identity, and of course that's true. So the way I talk about gender in animals isn't about an inner identity; it's about variation. There's not just one type of male and one type of female in most species. There's a variety of different ways to be male and female. And that's what I mean when I use the word gender with animals.
Yeah, okay. And could you give us an example in that, what you mean by that variety of ways to be male or female?
Right. So, for example, the classic case is in bluegill sunfish. There's three kinds of males. There's the big, large, territorial one that builds the nests. There's the next largest one, which is called a satellite male, which doesn't build nests, it isn't territorial, but it will partner with the large male. And together, particularly if that male doesn't have a good nesting spot, he'll partner with a smaller male, and together they will court a female. And then the third kind of male is what's called a sneaker, who doesn't bother with bonding, doesn't court anybody. He just tries to sort of steal paternity by squirting his gametes within the nest while others are having sex. So they get distracted and he kind of sneaks in. So these three varieties of males are different strategies. And the reason why, and this is stable over time, it's not like, you know, these are not just submissive, they're not runts, they're not juveniles, they're different kinds of males. And what's interesting is from year to year, the proportion, you know, the ratios will vary, but all three of them are maintained. And so what we know is that variety is something that always tends to work well for a species because they maintain it over time.
Right. In kind of in apes in general, there seems to be kind of a division with male apes, at least, in that either kind of beat everyone else into submission and they have the female, or they basically kind of carpet bomb the female with sperm in the hope that one of theirs will get through. Are humans kind of in the middle someplace in terms of that?
Right. Well, there's a lot more variety among apes than that, even. And in fact, even there's variety within an ape species. So we think of gorillas as being only in this style of the one big silverback and he will kill any rivals. But actually, that's not true anymore. There are lots of gorilla groups that are what we call multi-male, multi-female, and they can grow to very large size, and the males tolerate each other. And it upended everything we thought we knew, but there they are living their lives and they're doing just fine. So there's a lot of variety. Now, the question is, where do humans fit within the largest groups of males? That's really what you're getting at in that question. And let me tell you, anthropologists have been debating this for centuries, and I don't think we're going to resolve it anytime soon. But one thing we do know is that males and females in humans are not very different in body size. So, and that's something that is often very telling about lifestyle. So the fact that our body sizes are, you know, within 10% of each other on average tells us that we are sort of built for a pairing up. So dyads, the forming of a pair bond, seems to be something that we are built for. Now, whether it's promiscuous pair bond or an exclusive pair bond, that's where we really debate, because the size of the testicles often can help you figure that out, but ours is right in the middle. So very large testicles means it tends to go with promiscuity. Very small testicles tends to go with exclusivity. Well, our testicles relative to body size is sort of in the middle. So that doesn't help resolve the debate. And that's why anthropologists are going to continue to argue about it for some time.
Yeah. Is it even a useful debate to have anyway, in that it kind of implies some sort of anthropological determinism where we as humans have to act a certain way because the size of our testicles or whatever reason? Isn't it because we're at a point where we choose the way we want to act?
Sean, you said it perfectly. I don't think there's much value in the debate at all, because the one thing we have learned from studying all this is that humans are a variety. We're diversity. We are not very destined into one particular lifestyle. I mean, look at how we've spread all over the globe with all kinds of different lifestyles and different climates, different habitats, different diets. We are the ultimate generalists, ultimate omnivores, because that variability has allowed us adaptability. And that's a feature of our species, is that we are adaptable. So I agree with you 100% that there is no determinism on these matters, and that different times and places, that different patterns have emerged, but individuals will do what makes the most sense for them. And I think that that's our strength as a species, is that we don't just do what we're programmed to do, but actually we use our brains, we use our emotions, we use our social relationships, and we establish the way of life that we think works best for us.
Nathan Lentz is the author of The Sexual Evolution, How 500 Million Years of Sex, Gender and Mating Shape Modern Relationships. Nathan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean. It was a great interview.
Thank you. People rarely say that to me.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.